Good afternoon, and I'm opening as a subcommittee of the Senate Committee on Commerce and Workforce Development, and we do have a couple of legislators who are in other hearings, and so we're going to actually, just for the purpose of taking testimony, open as a subcommittee a public hearing on House Bill 2633, and Representative Matthews, would you like to come forward? And I'm sorry, Jeremy, first explain the bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2633 modifies the definition of supervisor employee in public employee collective bargaining law by requiring that in order to be considered a supervisor, an employer must have independent authority and that a public safety officer must have authority to impose economic discipline on an employee. The bill has no revenue impact, and a fiscal statement has been issued and is included in your packet.
Okay, and welcome back to the Commerce Committee, Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Greg Matthews, State Representative for House District 50, the great city of Gresham. Here today to testify on behalf of House Bill 2633. I was the carrier of this bill through the House. As I look at your list of testimony today, you have several folks that are going to be testifying on this, some for, some against. And there was a little bit of angst within our committee in business and labor. However, the one thing that we all agreed on is that there definitely was a problem because, the partisan lines seemed to be drawn on OSP, which would say that there was a problem within the Oregon State Troopers, but the problem goes far beyond that than just the troopers. The real problem in this is redefining the supervisory role and looking at supervisory language from pre-Senate Bill 750. Several things have been said about the impact of what this is going to be, the cost of it, and to the point where perhaps everybody from a chief on down would have to be in a bargaining unit. Simply not true, and I'll discuss that. What this really will do is it'll modify the definition for the purpose of the Public Employee Collective Bargaining Law. It'll amend ORS 243650 as it pertains to public safety officers, and the definition of supervisor employee would mean any individual having independent authority in the interest of the employer to hire, transfer, suspend, lay off, recall, promote, and discharge, along with a variety of other duties. It also states a public safety officer is defined in the ORS 181610, who merely assigns, transfers, or directs the work of other employees, but does not have the authority to impose economic discipline on those employees, is not a supervisor employee. This is critical. I myself serve as a company officer in a fire department, was a patrol officer in a police department, all in the city of Gresham 23 years. As a company officer, I am responsible to supervise employees. I manage my crew, so to speak. I cannot, however, give them the day off, assign them the day off, force them to go home without pay. I don't have that authority. What I do in my discipline role, if need be, is I would refer and direct. And I act under the direction, oftentimes, of the chief or the deputy chief. So in my capacity, it seems odd to me that there would be some fire departments out there that would have a company officer that would be a non-bargaining unit employee and then have bargaining unit employees that they're working with right alongside on the engine. Case in point, in the police department, if you look at law enforcement in general, forgetting about rank for a moment, if you will, because every rank structure is different, so the chain of command is a little different. But if you were to look at OSP, their troopers and senior troopers are on the road along with their sergeants, oftentimes exposed to the same liabilities and the very same risks. However, the way that they're treated in the event of, say, an officer shooting are inherently different. If you're part of the collective bargaining unit, you're given the language and protections within that of the process. When you're outside of that unit, you don't have that. It seems to me, in fact, I believe we agreed in the House because the minority report reflected that it should cover OSP only, but I believe in the House we had pretty good concurrence that this was a big problem, to expose these same liabilities and treat them two different ways. During the committee, we heard a lot of testimony before, and you'll hear some of that again today, some from officers that were opposed to the bill. And I asked specifically of two individuals if prior to Senate Bill 750, if they were part of the bargaining unit. And they said, no, not at that rank. They weren't. And so my point is, you know, when we look at this worst-case scenario of everybody's coming into a bargaining unit, it's simply not true because they weren't in the bargaining unit to begin with prior to Senate Bill 750. That language simply allowed some people to draw and to pull from. And the big impact has been somewhat of a ripple effect, I think, on, as I look at our organization, the willingness to promote or desire to promote. People aren't necessarily comfortable when there's no process to protect them. And when you look at it, really, if your top positions of leadership are secured only by those with no historical perspective, you're in for a problem. You know, I think it should be the desire of every police officer, not every, but many, that would want to work up through a system to a point of, you know, maybe someday becoming the chief or the assistant chief or captain. But quite honestly, some of them just don't want to do that because they see the impact of that legislation and what that's done to their bargaining unit and what it's done to those individuals. So you'll hear today, I'm sure, that some for and against again, but the one thing I want to address is there had been a letter circulated within the House, and I won't state the jurisdiction. I think they've taken care of that. But the letter was circulated with the untruths about how this is going to impact people. And the one thing that it really did that quite honestly offended me, and where you're at on the issue is up to you, but I also serve as a union president, and basically it indicated that if you're part of a bargaining unit, that you couldn't make a questionable call of integrity, that you wouldn't be able to hold people accountable, and you wouldn't be able to supervise people with your own bargaining unit. And I simply sit here today before you to say that's absolutely not true. I, as a union president and a lieutenant with the fire department, have had to sit through discipline hearings with people that quite honestly deserve that. To think that that would question or water down the integrity or compromise integrity of a profession, I did take offense to that. And I would again if that was brought forward again. The fact of the matter is police and firefighters take an oath much like we do as legislators. And they put their best effort forward. And I don't think necessarily being part of a bargaining unit or not diminishes the value of that integrity of that individual that takes that oath. So having said that, I do appreciate your time today. I obviously urge an aye vote, and I'm very strongly supportive of 2633 and hope you can be too. Again, there are two sides to this issue, but the real side, I think, is what was prior to Senate Bill 750, what are the impacts of that piece of legislation, and how has that impacted public safety? And for me, I see it having a negative impact and this having a very positive impact on righting the wrongs of the past.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. Any questions for Representative Matthews?
Senator George.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, thanks for coming over, and I always appreciate, seems like you're testifying almost every day in one of my committees. I really appreciate it. I guess the biggest concern I have with this bill is the issue of discipline. In my business, we're food processors. I really try to keep my quality control staff separated from my line staff. And the reason why is in food processing, I really want, not to be an adversarial relationship, but I want there to be checks and balances, and that there needs to be a really strict separation. One of the things we see in food processing facilities where there's not that separation is that when it gets too, when they're on the same team, sometimes they overlook food safety and food quality issues because there's a friendship and there's not that line of separation. I see this not that much different. I would like to see my lieutenants and captains and those types of things have a line of separation between maybe some of the other folks to make sure that there's in essence a discipline balance in there to make sure that we actually have discipline in the ranks. And I'm concerned about that's the biggest thing that concerns me, especially when you get into these smaller departments, that the discipline to me seems like it takes this bill and takes it and goes up. That's where it derails for me. So if you can address that, I'd really appreciate it.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator George, thank you for the question. And I guess I would say, not having any knowledge of the food processing industry, I don't know if your food process handlers and the quality checks are on the same line handling the same food every third person, but oftentimes we are engaged in the same scenario, in the same response, in the same accountability for handling that call. Certainly in a smaller jurisdiction, there is a little broader authority at some supervisor levels to do more. I can speak of our situation where to send somebody home without pay is just not in my charge. If I were in a smaller jurisdiction, it was. I certainly wouldn't be pulled into a bargaining unit by this bill. The integrity issue there, and you're presenting it differently, which I really appreciate. The integrity question about just the process alone. I would just like to say that I think I think what we're looking at is that every deal is different, you know, and the size does matter. And then some of your larger agencies, such as Portland, they had testified before, but also Portland Chiefs have their own organization. But I do think that there's flexibility built into this process. If you have a sheriff, for an example, and his undersheriff and perhaps a captain, those are the folks that are charged with those supervised duties of administering and impacting people economically. They wouldn't be in that bargaining unit. But a sergeant on the road, we have to kind of remember, if you will, that they're responding to the same call, and they're put in the same line of fire as those patrol officers. And we treat them in every which way we can, in terms of their use on the road, but yet we treat them differently when they're exposed to liability and react in the manner that sometimes, unfortunately, happens in that profession. So I understand where you would be concerned, and coming from your industry, it makes sense the way you're pushing it, but this is, you know, public safety is a little bit different animal in this, that it's difficult. The fire service in general, three or four person companies, depending on where you're at, Gresham happens to be three, you know, we're on the same rig together. I'm responsible for those in and out of the station. I'm responsible for them on the call. To be outside the bargaining unit and have that same authority, yet we're together in the fire, that can be a problem too. I don't see it becoming a question.
Follow up. Representative, I guess that actually, my concern is that I would expect managers to go into the calls, because that's where you would actually see if somebody was doing something unsafe in the workplace, it risks people's lives in your arena. And so that's where discipline is even more important. I mean, I think that's why, you know, our police officers and then our fire folks and all of our public safety wear uniforms, and it's much more, the idea is there's discipline in there, and that if you were doing something very dangerous inside of a fire, that if a supervisor saw you doing that, that there needs to be an ability to say, hey, you did something wrong there, and not feel like, I'm not saying it's an integrity issue. It's like all of us. I'm much easier on senators' bills than I am on representatives' bills, because I work with these guys more often. It's just the way it is.
Sure, I can appreciate that.
And if I sent a bill over to you, you'd have much easier time, you know, over on that side criticizing it, just because we don't. It's just, it's human nature. It's not an ethics or it's an integrity issue. It's about how you keep that line of separation to make sure that we have discipline in the ranks. And I guess that's my. You're not quite getting me over that hump, and that's what I'd have to say.
And Madam Chair and Senator George, and in response to that, I would say that I actually, notwithstanding any union representation, I find myself extremely effective as a supervisor because I get to know these people really well and my connection with them and the fact that I can address these issues with them and handle that. In our organization, the only officers that are outside the bargaining unit are our battalion chiefs, our deputy chief, and our chief. But then again, we don't have a huge administrative staff. Our captains, our lieutenants, our firefighters are all part of the bargaining unit. And I guess I do understand, and I appreciate, you know, your take on this, but I personally don't agree that there's a problem with the ability to supervise and a link to the bargaining unit and a loyalty to somebody. I'll be perfectly honest with you. I've seen plenty of people and worked with our chief on a number of them that deserve discipline. Very good friends of mine with very strong family members that quite honestly didn't deserve that disappointment in their life either, but it was the right thing to do, and they needed to be held accountable. And I take a great deal of pride in our profession and what we do. It's kind of like within this building here is that, you know, ultimately as legislators, we have a great deal of authority. We give some of the authority to our LAs, or we give some to staff members, but we don't grant it all. At some point, there is that fine line of separation of we make those decisions, and we make very strong decisions. Our LAs are given some more than others of you know, the ability to perhaps respond to constituent email and those things. We'd like to, we just don't do that. But when it comes down to ultimate authorities and decisions and commitment on votes, we make that call. And I'm not saying it comes down to one individual in public safety, because it doesn't. It depends on the organization and the structure. But I also don't see a problem with being able to supervise friends.
Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you very much.
Welcome, Senator Manus Anderson. Okay, we're going to come back to this bill, but for right now, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2633 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3140. And Representative Huffman.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3140A extends the maximum amount of weeks in which a qualified worker can receive work share unemployment compensation benefits from 26 up to 52 weeks, declares an emergency effective on passage. There's no revenue impact, and there's a fiscal statement which has been issued, which accompanies your materials.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm John Huffman, State Rep for District 59. And in your packets, I gave you a map and also an informational sheet. And I'm basically going to mirror my testimony on the informational sheet, but update it because Director Tom Byerly from the Unemployment Department actually brought in some new numbers. About 6 weeks ago, I got an email from a constituent that works for a company in Madras called Keith Manufacturing, and they asked if I could do something because their work share program was getting ready to expire the end of April. And I had to go back and say, what is work share? I'd never heard of it before. And the Employment Department and Unemployment Department just happened to be before our Ways and Means Subcommittee with their budget about that time. And so I went to Lori and Tom and I said, what is work share and is there anything we can do about it? Well, they explained that work share is a program that allows a company to stay in business without laying off employees, which would be 100% unemployed, and all of those funds would be coming out of the unemployment trust fund. But it will allow the employer the flexibility to, say, put that employee on 70% work week. And the 30%, or nearly 30%, I guess it's not 100% of that 30%, but nearly all of that person's salary would be made up from the unemployment trust fund, or at least that's what we're asking. Under work share, the first 26 weeks is actually funded under a federal program. But at the end of that 26 weeks, Oregon has no mechanism to extend that to allow the recession or that business to get an uptick or an additional contract to put the employee back on 100% of payroll. As a part of this, the employer is also required to continue health care benefits. So what it allows to happen for the employee and the business owner is that they keep a stable, educated, trained workforce that has health care benefits, but it lessens their payroll to mirror more what their production is. One of the benefits to Lars Larson asked me the other day, well, he was trying to figure out how employers were scamming the system based on this, and I said, well, there's really no upside for the employer to use work share. You would assume an employer wants to be at full production, and this just allows them, when they don't have enough contracts to be at full production, to have an opportunity to make that up through the work share program. What this House bill does is 3140 allows Oregon to extend the 26 weeks up to another 26 weeks, and that 26 weeks would come out of the unemployment trust fund. Statistically, in 2007, fewer than 50 employers were using the WorkShare program. In 2008, that number had grown to 70 employers. And 3 weeks ago, that number was 477 employers. And today, Tom just told me that 543 companies are enrolled in the WorkShare program. It's just a reflection of where our economy is. There are an average of 16 employers or employees per employer under the WorkShare program. I'll say that again. There are an average of 16 employees per employer. The average weekly payment in 2009 has been $84 per week. Employers have traditionally used the WorkShare program between 4 and 16 weeks for seasonal slowdowns, and an estimated 10% of participating employers using WorkShare will exhaust the 26 weeks currently allowed and use the full 26 weeks of this extension. As I mentioned, the alternative to work share in many cases will be full unemployment, and 100% of the unemployment would come out of the trust fund as opposed to 20 to 40% as provided under the work share program. And if that's clear as mud, I brought my friend Tom Byerly from the Unemployment Department along to clear it up. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. And Tom?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tom Byerly, Administrator for the Unemployment Insurance Division of the Employment Department, and I've been working real closely with Representative Huffman on this extension, and he's characterized the bill very well. I'd be happy to answer any questions that the committee might have on the bill and how it works.
Senator Monis Anderson.
How do you let employers know about this? How would they know? I would think that there would be employers out there that would definitely want to take advantage of this.
Madam Chair, Senator Monis Anderson, that's a great question. Thank you. We have information posted on our website. We have flyers that we send out, and often when we hear about layoffs, we will visit employers to let them know of these other programs that might be available. We haven't done an all-out marketing blitz because it is quite labor-intensive. The employers have to fill out part of the form as well as employees, and we manually handle every claim. But we're in the process of automating it right now so we can process them much quicker and actually save staff time and save administrative costs. And at that point, we will advertise it more. It has worked out really well, as you can see by the explosion in usage of the program.
That's great. And I had a question about the fiscal. Looks like there's quite a range in the projected fiscal. Could you explain that, Tom?
Yes, Madam Chair. We don't know for sure how many employers might use all 26 weeks, might use all 52 weeks. So we provided some ranges in the fiscal just so that you could get an idea of where it might end up. It actually could possibly result in a savings to the trust fund because, as Representative Huffman said, if someone is completely unemployed, then their unemployment insurance comes 100% out of the trust fund. And even if they're on a 40% work week for 52 weeks, they still don't draw their full maximum award on an unemployment insurance claim. You'd have to draw 50% a week to get to that point. It also prevents claims from going on extensions, so it actually could be characterized as a potential savings to the trust fund. So we gave those ranges because we honestly don't know.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you both for your testimony. And one more witness is signed up, J.L. Wilson.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. For the record, J.L. Wilson representing AOI. Just quickly, we do support the program. It seems like it's had an explosion of utilization. It seems like I'm directing someone to it every day now. It's a program I hadn't heard of a year ago. Now it's very much on the radar, so we support the expansion.
Great. Any questions for JL? Okay. Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who'd like to testify on House Bill 3140? Okay, seeing no one, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3140A, open a work session on House Bill 3140A. And Senator Telford's not here, so.
And I'm assuming all we need to do is move the bill. There's no amendments at this point.
No amendments.
House Bill 3140A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
And Senator Prezansky moves House Bill 3140A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Discussion.
Go ahead.
I really like the program, and Representative Huffman, thank you for bringing it to our attention. A lot of us, including myself, did not realize the extent of the work share program. And I'm hoping that, Tom, maybe as you are redoing everything, that you'll be able to give us in our offices a little bit more information so we will be able to provide that to constituents and companies within our districts that may find this as a benefit. It sounds like a really good program, so thank you.
Madam Chair, if I might, John Huffman again for the record. Senator Prezansky, you reminded me that I was remiss in thanking several people, Lori Warner, Tom Byerly, Representative Buckley, because, as I mentioned, this came to me late in the session, and so Peter and I scrambled around trying to find a bill that would fit because, as I mentioned earlier, kind of glossed over it a bit, the people on the front edge of the WorkShare program, their benefits expired about a week and a half ago, and so we've been working really hard to try to get this through, and I just appreciate you taking the time to hear it quickly.
Okay, thank you. Glad we got that in. Okay, any further discussion? Pam, please call the roll.
Senator George.
Aye.
Senator Bozomski.
Aye.
Senator Mother Sanders.
Aye.
Senator Calvert.
Excused.
Chair Rosenbaum.
Aye. Motion carries. And so this bill is headed to the floor. Do we have a volunteer who'd like to carry the bill on
I'll do it.
Senator Bozomski. Okay. And I will close the work session on House Bill 3140. And we have, I think we'll conclude, come back to 2633, but we do have one more bill that doesn't have too many people signed up, so let's knock that one out too, and I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2744. Jeremy.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2744 is similar to Senate Bill 805, which we heard earlier in this session. The measure requires employers of 25 or more persons during a period of military conflict to provide up to 14 days unpaid leave to an employee who is a spouse of a member of the armed forces, the National Guard, or military reserve prior to the member being deployed or redeployed to active duty. Makes failure to grant leave or discriminating against spouse unlawful employment practice, requires Bureau of Labor and Industries to enforce provisions of the Act, declares emergency and it's effective on passage, there is no revenue impact, and a fiscal statement has been issued, and you have that in your PAC, indicating a fairly minimal administrative impact.
Great, and with his usual impeccable timing, I see that Representative Sal Esquivel has joined us, so if you'd like to come forward and tell us about this bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's due to my wife is the reason I'm here on time. You have before us a bill that was actually brought up when Senator Bates and I were having a town hall meeting. Oh, for the record, Sal Esquivel, Representative District 6. And this lady asked why we were unable to have 2 weeks' time or so with her husband before he departed for Iraq and when he came home, and wanted to know if we could dovetail that into the family leave program. Well, that's exactly what we have accomplished here. And let me explain to you from a veteran's point of view on how important it is to have some downtime. When I came home from Vietnam, one day I had an M16. 3 days later, I was stepping off of a curb in San Diego. And that's quite a dramatic change for anyone. And if you'd have had some time with your family, it would definitely have helped the veteran and the family. You go away for a year and you're in a combat zone, you change, your attitude changes and you change. You see things you shouldn't see, you experience things you shouldn't experience, but that's part of what you do as a soldier. But more importantly, your family changes. The wife has been doing things, or the husband, depending upon whether what gender you are when you're in a combat zone. When you come home, that individual has done everything for themselves for a year. The attitudes, the approach, and everything changes. So it's very important that they have some downtime, but more or less, more importantly, downtime together. It's very critical. I think this war is different than any other war. Whereas in the war that I fought, everyone was 19 years old. That was about our average age. And you spent a year there and then you came home and you were done. This one's different. Most of the people that are in country in a combat zone are married. They're family people. They have children. Some of them go two and three and up to four tours. This is very vital for their relationship with their spouse, is when they come home. Does it cost us anything? No, because it's part of the family leave. Is it important? Extremely, to our people that are servicing this country and in a combat zone and a theater today. So I would hope that we would get behind this bill. I think $10,000, I believe, is the
expense I saw on it. And, you know, I think that would be have to be very liberal in the aspect that the only thing we're changing is some verbiage in the existing family leave to include this. So I would be surprised if it was even close to that. But, you know, it is what it is. And I am available for any question.
Okay, and Senator Manis Anderson has one.
Just a real quick question. You said spouse rather than family member, and there are many of us who don't have a spouse but maybe have someone very dear to us that may be going overseas.
Be the same way.
Okay. It just seems like spouse is not the correct term at this point in time, but I don't want
to hold things up. She happened to be a spouse, Senator.
Yes. Okay.
Okay, thank you. And so I had a question. Does these 14 days, are they included in the 12 weeks that people are entitled to for other purposes under the family leave law?
Madam Chair, yes, they are. They are included. They are not additional family leave.
Okay. Any other questions for the representative? Yes, Senator George.
Okay. When it says 14 and then 15 days. Those are actually so and days a week. You're actually on 15 days. You're actually talking 3 full weeks of leave.
I believe it's, Madam Chair, Senator George. I believe it says 14 days. Now it does not say business days. It says 14 days. So it's 2 weeks.
Yes. Follow up.
I guess that's what I'm asking because it's a big difference. If you're talking about work days and people work on 8-hour days, is it over a 2-week period? So there's two. Let's say, for instance, my normal work, you know, I'm a part-time employee. I'm trying to figure out: is it the number of days I work, or is it the number of days total from the time I start to the time I end?
Madam Chair, Senator George, it's 14 days.
Okay.
It's not a business day. It's
not a work day.
It's not a work day. Okay. And a work day is a business day. It is 14 days.
Okay.
Yes, Senator
Przanski. Madam Chair, thank you. Sal, based on your answer to Senator Manis Anderson, I just glanced at the bill again because the way I read it and the way I look at it now, looking at the wrong copy probably.
The Ann Gross bill?
Ann Gross.
Okay. I just want to make sure that the spouse has been expanded to domestic partners and others that would be in that significant position.
Madam Chair, Senator Przanski, the intent was whatever we is eligible under the family leave bill will be eligible under this bill.
Yeah. Madam Chair, if I can follow up.
Yes, follow up.
I still see the language. It says military spouse. It seems to me, knowing what the intent of the sponsor is, that the definitions or words that are used may need to be, let's say, amended to carry that forward, and as to who that's going to include or not include.
Yeah, I would agree. It looks like the way it's drafted right now, it just applies to the spouse. So we do have somebody from the agency that would administer it here, and so they might be able to clarify that as well.
Madam Chair, Senator Przanski, I wouldn't have any heartburn at all to amending that, but I was under the assumption that it went exactly the way the family leave bill was, since this was going to be inserted into that family leave, and that's guidelined by state and federal.
And that was the intent, was to have it be the same family members who
Madam
qualified.
Chair, that's correct.
Okay.
Great.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Representative Escobel. We have a few more people. I'm going to call Val Conley, J.L. Wilson, and Brigadier General Mike Caldwell. Actually, why don't you just sit tight for a minute. I think maybe I will call Bob Estabrook from the Bureau of Labor and Industries because of that technical question that just came up before we call the rest of you. And good afternoon.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Bob Estabrook from the Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industries, here with the intention to say that we are supportive of the bill, and now also to say that our reading of the bill as it is written was that it be limited to the spouses of service members. I would agree with the concern that's come up that it's not it does not include other folks beyond specifically spouses the way that it's written. I think that there may have been a little bit of miscommunication between the sponsor, folks who drafted amendments, and how we sort of got here today. But I think the Bureau would be happy to be involved in crafting some language that would clarify and make this more consistent with the OFLA and FEMLA protected leaves that the Bureau of Labor and Industries currently enforces.
Okay, any questions for the agency? Okay, we would, I think the committee would be happy to work with you on clarifying that in an amendment. So, okay, looks like that's it.
Okay.
Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
So now I'll call Val Conley, J.L. Wilson, and Brigadier General Caldwell.
Thank you very much.
Whoever wants to go first, please go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell, Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department. I'd like to comment that this is a very good piece of legislation, I think, with respect to what we have noticed over the last several years of this these two wars, is that many of the things that have been written into statute and other parts of our both federal and state legislative process were written 50 years ago or with 50 years ago mindset. Today and the current conflicts, it's common practice that soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, during the one-year stay that they are deployed to Iraq, that they typically get a two-week termed R&R, where they come rest and recuperation, where they come back to the United States. Federal government's changed their policy somewhat. Initially, they would get them back to an airhead in Philadelphia, then they had to get their own way home. They're doing a little better job on that now. We're getting them closer, so there's less impact on the family. But nevertheless, these men and women do desire to come home. They have two short weeks, and then they got to go back to a combat zone. So I think anything that we can do to make that two-week period just a little bit easier for that loved one, whether it be their spouse or their significant other in any respect, as you just discussed, I think is to our benefit. And again, it's not a paid situation where their employer is not required to pay them to take this time off, but I think it makes just good public policy to make sure that if somebody has a different desire, that we as a public say, no, we think this is good business. So we support it. We're very delighted that Representative Escobar saw fit to bring it forward. So with that, I'll let the others speak and answer any questions you may have.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Val Conley. I am the Veterans Services Division Administrator for the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and I am here today to support House Bill 2744, which will allow military spouses / family members, whatever is determined, a total of 14 days unpaid leave to spend time with the service member prior to deployment or while the service member is on leave from deployment. As I'm sure you are aware, military families sacrifice a great deal when service members are deployed. House Bill 2744 is intended to take just a little bit of the sting out of the separation that a family will face by allowing military families the opportunity to spend a little more time with the service member. Currently, it may be impossible for a military spouse to take even a few days off from work to spend time with their spouse before a deployment that will separate the couple for 12 months or more. Simply put, not every working spouse has enough vacation, sick leave, or comp time to spend time with their deploying spouse. Under these circumstances, there are two options. Either go to work and not spend those last few days with the service member, or lose your job so you can be with your spouse before the deployment. House Bill 2744 recognizes that neither of these is a very good option and authorizes these military spouses, family members, unpaid leave if they work for a company that employs 25 people or more. We recognize this is a sacrifice for the business, but given what these families are sacrificing and could sacrifice once that service member is deployed, we think House Bill 2744 is quite reasonable. I want to thank the committee for your time, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Okay, I think we'll hold questions till we've heard from the entire panel.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum, and members. For the record, J.L. Wilson representing Associated Oregon Industries. We're actually okay with the bill. Members have a very high level of sensitivity toward this situation. Our only condition was that it comport with existing family medical leave law, which it in fact does. So if the change that Senator Prozanski wants to make, I believe, is consistent with law, that's fine. I would also add, I think the 14 days is awkward. On page 2, line 9 of the bill, I think family leave might be measured in weeks, so to say 2 weeks would probably be more clear, but that's my only real suggestion.
Yeah, I had the same question, so we can take a look at that and work with the agency on that to make sure it's consistent. Okay, any questions for this panel?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Prozanski.
Just to put on the record, and Jill, if you want to look at this under the family leave, I would suggest that we would use the term family member as it does in 159A.150 sub 4. That seems to be lift that out as the defined group of employees.
That's fine.
Okay. Other questions?
Madam Chair,
yes.
I might just add, we count by the day. So when a soldier leaves Iraq, they got 14 calendar days of leave. So that's probably where the 14
sure.
days came from, because that's how we operate.
Well, I think we can achieve that result and be consistent at the same time, and that's what we'll work on. Okay, thank you very much. And so we'll work on an amendment to this and bring it back. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2744. And that brings us back to where we started. So I'm going to reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2633. And we've got a lot of people signed up. I think we'll alternate panels. And let's start with Brian DeLashmit, Bob Livingston, Robert Davis, and Pat Campbell are signed up together. So if you can pull up an extra chair, we can get all four of you up here.
Came unprepared. My glasses are not on yet. Sorry. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brian DeLashman. I'm here representing the Oregon Council of Police Associations, the Oregon State Police Officers Association, commonly known as the State Troopers, the Association of Oregon Corrections Employees, and the Federation of Oregon Parole and Probation Officers, roughly 7,000 members statewide. I wanted to let you know, obviously, that 2633 is one of the top two priorities for the associations that I've just mentioned. Let me kind of go through a little bit of a history, and I know Bob's going to touch on a lot of this stuff, but in 1995, as many of you know, Senate Bill 750 was implemented. We believe it went too far in excluding workers who are not true supervisors and who are we would consider lead workers or foremen. 750 excluded workers who did not have the typical supervisory functions of hiring, firing, disciplining, adjusting or resolving grievances, laying off or recalling workers, promoting, assigning or assigning rewards. We believe this bill would correct that situation and get us back to a much more sensible, common sense approach to who is in fact a supervisor and who's not a supervisor, who's truly a lead worker, essentially doing the same functions as many of the other folks. You'll hear from a number of the patrol officers and Jeff Lady from the OSPOA as far as the functions that they actually do, and they're side by side with, in many cases, in our cases, sergeants and police service. We're talking different situations. You heard from Representative Matthews as far as fire service, but we're particularly talking about sergeants here. Let me let you know that not all jurisdictions exclude sergeants from their bargaining units currently. There's a mix statewide. A majority of them do not exclude sergeants from the bargaining unit. It's a choice under the existing statute that local jurisdiction has made to not include those folks. It may be by their function, but even with some of the functions that would, under the current statute, put them in the category of supervisory, those jurisdictions have not put those folks into the bargaining units. Others, in fact, have with the change of 715-1995. Under the current system, some of the best and brightest choose not to promote. You'll hear from some others on that, but what we're finding in local jurisdictions and in OSP is that there, in fact, is, by what many of the patrolmen call, a ceiling. They choose not to promote for a variety of reasons, in which you'll hear, whether it's protection under collective bargaining, whether it's the fact that they're on a patrol, they are involved as often as a patrol officer in officer-involved shootings. They don't have the same protections legally or litigation-wise as a patrol does that the bargaining units. Let me talk a little bit about what you're going to hear from the opposition. And I have written testimony that you can, you'll see that I've addressed some of the same issues, but let me touch on a couple of them. You will hear that this will put everybody in the bargain unit, up to and included, in some cases, the chiefs and the sheriffs, and that only the mayor or the city council or the county commission would be excluded under this. That was not the case prior to 1995. It will not be the case under this bill. We are just attempting to return to what we believe, as I indicated, was a more sensible definition of who's a supervisor, and for us, it's primarily sergeants. The second piece that I'd like to talk about is you'll hear that this automatically puts those folks back in the bargain unit. That also is not true. It only puts people back in the bargain unit if they don't, in fact, have the supervisory responsibilities outlined in this bill, and they choose to go back into the bargaining unit. So they would have a unit clarification and ultimately a vote. So let's say that even if they did not have true supervisory responsibility under this bill, if it were to pass, if a group of sergeants in a particular jurisdiction said, we don't want to go back in the bargaining unit, we like where we're at right now, they would have a vote. And if the majority of them chose not to go back in the bargaining unit, they don't go back in the bargaining unit. Nobody forces them back into the bargaining unit. The next thing you'll hear is it will cost millions of dollars. Let me address that a little bit. It was not true unless they're excluding current officers from bargaining as a way to cut costs, such as excluding folks, sergeants, making them salaried employees, and then not paying them for overtime. If, in fact, they're treating the current people who are supervisory as hourly employees and paying them overtime if they're working them more hours, then I see no ability to increase the cost for the local governments. You'll also hear, and I was a little surprised by, and obviously you get an opportunity to hear the testimony of the Association of Working Counties, but one of their bullet points is that this definition would apply to all program areas in county government, including public works, parks, recreation, health and human services, building codes, planning, and public safety. I think if you read the bill, it specifically says public safety officers. So I don't know how they get to that point. If they can point to me as to how they got there, that's not our intent, and we'd be happy to clarify or amend the bill. But we don't believe it does that. So I wanted to address that point very quickly. You've also heard, and I know that Representative Matthews talked a little bit about that interaction with Senator George's question about the ability or integrity of investigations. You currently have people that do internal investigations that are currently in the bargaining unit, whether they're a supervisor or not a supervisor, especially in police. If the contention is that those people currently are not doing those jobs with integrity and ethics, that somehow we've mythically put these additional people into the bargaining unit, then I think they're really challenging the ethics and the integrity of all public safety officers in this state. And I think you will hear from some officers that will take exception to that today. I know that they expressed some real dismay at their argument when it was made on the House side. In closing, one additional thing I want to bring to your attention, and I actually was a little reluctant about bringing this up, but I was brought to my attention today that at least in one circumstance, one jurisdiction today, that an officer was called and told that if he had any aspirations at all about progressing through the ladder, that he would reconsider his position about coming to the building today on this bill. This is the kind of stuff that's going on around this bill. There has been a lot of misinformation. We quite frankly, are attempting to get to a very clear, bright line as to who truly is a lead worker and a foreman, and who's a supervisor, a standard that we can use statewide. But quite frankly, that angers me, that kind of a tactic. And I hope that it ends here. With that, I'll be happy to pass it to my colleague, the firefighter.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Livingston, representing the Oregon State Firefighters Council. And like my colleague from House District 50, Representative Greg Matthews, I too am a firefighter. I currently work for the Salem Fire Department, but I want to make it clear for the record that my opinions and my comments for today are those of mine and of the Oregon State Firefighters Council and do not reflect my position with the City of Salem. Briefly, I think I would like to specifically address Senator George's question with respect to discipline. A couple of comments that I'd like to make, serving in a similar rank and function as Representative Matthews, is that specific to discipline, you really need to think about it. It's been my experience over the past 16 years that really less than 1% of the job duties, particularly for the people that we're talking about that would apply to this bill, really evolves around discipline. It simply is a very minor portion of what you do. A second point I'd like to make on is just remember, these are paramilitary organizations. This is not like your private sector job. There is clear delineation of command and control. And specifically, particularly to an emergency event, whether you're a police officer or a firefighter, we all fall under the guise of what is referred to as the incident management system, where there is absolutely one person that is absolutely in charge, whether it's a single fire engine response or whether it's an incident that may occur here at the Capitol where you would have multiple jurisdictions involved with that. There's a clear delineation and protocols and procedures that fall under the incident management system. And finally, two other points to that specifically that I would like to address is I think it's fair to say that if you do polling of those, you know, whether it's at the local or national level, what services do people appreciate most that government provides? And I think on a consistent basis, much to the chagrin of my colleagues to the right, you'll probably hear that fire is usually number one, but a close second would be police, and that has to do with the integrity and honesty and really the services that those people provide. And so unlike what some people may assert, whether you're a brand new recruit firefighter or police officer or the police chief, I think it's fair to say that all of us in the public safety sector recognize that our integrity and trust in what you require of us is first and foremost, irrespective of whether you're in a bargaining unit or not in a bargaining unit. And specifically to accountability, you know, let's not forget that I did serve on the DPSST board. I was the chair of the Fire Policy Committee. We also, and you have empowered many agencies and within the state to also regulate those issues to make sure that we uphold those issues of integrity and make sure that we're holding people accountable. The other thing I would like to hopefully I hope you won't hear questioning whether somebody's going to have a double standard when it comes to accountability. As a point in turn, my night job at work is I'm basically in charge of over 500,000 pieces of equipment. I'm also in charge of making decisions as a paramedic on what type of medications, whether to intubate a person, making life and death decisions truly with people. So I hope you don't hear whether I'm a union member or a non-union member, whether when it comes to those issues from accountability, whether you can do those things, because simply those are just scare tactics in my opinion. Specifically to the bill, flexibility, we believe that this bill provides flexibility. I think you heard from previous testimony is that one size does not fit all. I think in the past we've had questions on, well, why don't you define what the rank is and just go from that. And I think the reason for that is this is consistent across states, is that if you're a captain in a fire department, may be different in one jurisdiction and the responsibilities that you have than from another. Another example of that is that a police lieutenant is different than a fire lieutenant. And so having a definition of supervisory makes sense and actually provides for more flexibility for local jurisdictions to address their needs and allow them to to continue to maintain their organization as they see fit. The other thing I think it's important to point out is that since Senate Bill 750 and the passage of that legislation in 1995, Oregon is by far the most, has the most restrictive language as it relates to whether an individual can be in a bargaining unit or not. In the House, and unfortunately today, we had a longtime attorney and professor that put that on the record, that by far, when you look at the statutes, whether at the state level or in some local jurisdictions that don't have collective bargaining in the state but may have it at a municipal level, Oregon by far is the most restrictive language when it comes to who can qualify to be in a bargaining and who can't. Quickly, I'd like to just talk a little bit about process. Please look at House Bill 2633. You'll note that this bill only applies to those bargaining agreements that come in after the effective date of this bill, which would be January 1st, 2010. Also in that, you would have to delve into the administrative rules that the Employment Relations Board works under. We're not asking for a change, as Brian alluded to. One, you would still have to have an election. But the other thing that you would also have to do is, this is if this is for an existing bargaining unit, and if employer would like to challenge that, administrative rules would address that, and there's only certain time frames and windows of opportunity of when you can do that. So simply put, I don't think there's going to be a floodgate of these things. We're not asking for a change in that unit clarification process. And, you know, I'm sure that I'd be happy to provide you with the specific administrative rules if you wanted to get into those details of the bill. But in closing, to allow other people to testify on this, I think really the fundamental question as policymakers that you have to ask yourself is this. Do these public safety officers who are doing like-in-kind work, responding to everyday emergencies, deserve the right to bargain over wages, hours, working conditions, and their safety? And so simply put, if you believe they have the right to, in the 21st century, be able to have a contract to do the types of work that they do, then I hope that you would support this bill. And with that, I would take questions or turn it over to the rest of the panel, Madam Chair.
Okay, let's keep going.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Pat Campbell. I'm a police sergeant with the city of Beaverton. I've worked for Beaverton Police for 28 years, and I've been a sergeant for 12 of those years. I'll be brief, but just for a moment, I'd like to put you inside a typical day that I work. I make arrests, just like the officers I work with. I make traffic stops. I respond to calls. I make decisions about what kind of work are we going to do to accomplish the tasks that the department has set forth for me to take care of. As a consequence, I'm exposed to the same liability. And one of my concerns is that if this bill were not to pass, that my ability to at least negotiate for medical benefits or have an attorney that was a phone call away in case I needed some legal assistance would be somehow compromised. One of the reasons that I have not promoted over the past 12 years is precisely that. Our lieutenants don't have the same kind of coverage. And if, in fact, this bill did not pass, and our department has not yet taken a position on this, but if they decided that the sergeants were going to become management, I would be forced to demote. And the experience that I bring to every briefing that I walk into would, in a sense, go away. As a sergeant, I don't transfer people. I don't promote them. I don't suspend them. I don't fire them. I don't impose economic sanctions. I don't even assign them to the positions that they're in. I do write commendations, but I don't issue them. I do evaluations, but I don't have the final word on the final rating. I do complaints, citizen complaints. The department trusts me to investigate allegations that result in tort claims. They trust me to do use of force investigations, criminal allegations against officers. The department trusts me as a sergeant, even though I am also in the association, to make those kinds of ask those kinds of questions, conduct those kinds of investigations. But in the end, I have to pass my findings up for somebody else to decide what the discipline is going to be. Madam Chair and Senator George, I would like to address the question that you had initially, and it had to do with the ability to discipline. And I think that's a good question. I think the difference between perhaps other kinds of work and the work that I do is that one of the reasons that I want officers that I work with to follow the rules is I'm on the line also. My safety depends on us following the rules. And if somebody doesn't, I have no pangs of conscience to install discipline, to call somebody out. Because it's not somebody else, and I'm not sure how the food industry works, but it's not going to be somebody I don't see who's going to be affected. It's going to be that policeman in front of me. The other people we work with, that this officer here has not done the right job, has not done the right thing. And we have to straighten that out. We cannot let that happen. And I think the other thing, and the firefighter got very close to it, but I think the most important issue here is I may have the ability to go buy food someplace else, but you do not have the ability to go to a different police officer. When I show up and the men and women I work with show up, you have no choice. And we have to give you the best. And to expect or to anticipate or to believe that perhaps I would go easy on somebody because I'm in the same association with them couldn't be further from the truth. Thank you.
Okay.
Have you seen, sir? Yeah, sure.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Robert Davis. I've been a police officer for 18 years, a patrol sergeant for 10 years, a member of the Beaverton Police Association. When this was presented to the House, I kept hearing arguments that sergeants can't or won't objectively scrutinize or investigate officers because they belong in the same bargaining unit. And that really, really hit me hard when I heard that, and I think Brian touched on that as well. I think that's fantasy. I think it's the only thing that management can throw at you to kind of shock you regarding this bill. For me, it's insulting that I would lower my integrity just to look out for one of these officers. I would have to ask you, do you think I would really risk my entire career to minimize something an officer had done wrong, that I would risk my pension and everything I've worked for and all my integrity? I'm fairly passionate about that because I enjoy being held to a high standard. I enjoy taking that oath and having people say, oh, I could never do your job. And, you know, and I look at them and I go, yeah, you probably couldn't. So I enjoy being held to that high standard. I work shoulder to shoulder with these officers. I have the same risks. It's critical for me to have the same protection that they have of my choice, to have the same kind of legal counsel of my choice or something that I can bargain for. Senator George, you were talking about quality control and how discipline can help affect that, and how it might be human nature for people to look the other way if they're all part of the same group. I would have to say that my job is about suppressing human nature. As police officers, we go into dangerous situations. Human nature would be to go the other direction. So when it comes to that kind of human nature about taking care of your brothers in arms, I can understand how people outside law enforcement might think that we would do that. But I'm here to tell you that nothing is further from the truth. I hold my people very accountable. I don't want them to tarnish this career that I've dedicated almost 20 years of my life to. So I would ask that you consider my perspective on this House bill, and thank you.
Madam Chair, if I may, I did forget one additional handout that I passed out. You may be puzzled why I gave it to you, but along with my written testimony, I gave you a measure summary from Senate Bill 445A from 2003. The reason why I did that is that it shows physical, no minimal, it says minimal physical impact, no statement issued. So the statements about costs and millions of dollars doesn't ring true between different sessions. It's the same bill. It's the same issue. It's come up again. In fact, if you were to take the fiscal statement from 1995, in which it went the other way, in which these people were excluded, it didn't show that there was a cost savings. So the cost issue is a new issue that's been thrown on the table. Thank you.
Okay, questions? Senate
Senator George?
Brian, I think that the concern comes from, and just in hearing your testimony and then reading the other testimony, comes on the bill, page 4, line 6, under the definition of supervisory employee. It says, and what you've done in this bill is you've amended two different things. In lines 16 through 18, you're talking about safety officers and employees. But in line 6, you're actually amending all supervisory employees under collective bargaining. And so what you've done is that you have included everything that I can see for management in all areas of state of county offices. By putting the word independent in line 6, what you have is you've expanded it far beyond public safety by having that word in there. In addition, the way it reads, interestingly enough, is it's difficult then when you put the word independent in there. Lines 8 then has the words or, and then what you have to then ask yourself with the word independent, are those inclusive or exclusive lines? And so I think if you want to clean that up, you're going to have to amend line 6 in that language. You agree with me on that?
Madam Chair, Senator George, I'll relook at that, but that was not the intent, and I'm surprised by this issue raising after we had some pretty extensive discussion on the House side.
I think it's a pretty clear reading. Another quick question.
Follow up.
Brian, just so I understand, you made the statement, and I just want to make sure I understand how this works. You said that if there was a group of sergeants or lieutenants that wanted to be included in the collective bargaining, that they would need to get together and there would need to be a vote of those sergeants to be in the union. As I understand how it is, the collective bargaining agreement is between the union and the management, and that would the whole local vote on whether or not to include the sergeants, or whether it just be the sergeants that would be voting on whether they'd be coming in?
Madam Chair, Senator George, it's my understanding it's actually a two-step process. First is there would have to be clarification as to whether or not they qualified under the new statute to be in the bargaining unit, and then it would be a vote of those folks, not the entire union.
Just those folks.
Yeah.
Okay. Senator Monica Anderson.
Thank you. Okay. I'm only familiar really with Multnomah County Sheriffs, and they were the line people, the on the ground patrol officers, and when they talked, they said, I really would like to take the test or whatever you do to become sergeant, but it doesn't pay because you don't get overtime. Is that correct? When you're in supervisory, you don't get overtime.
Madam Chair, Senator Mona Sanderson, depends on the jurisdiction. That is the case with OSP, that when you become a sergeant, you're considered a supervisor and you're a salaried employee, so you don't get overtime. Each jurisdiction is different, not all in which when you become a sergeant, even if you're excluded from the bargaining unit or salaried, some of them are hourly and they do get time and a half.
But anyway, I think the point I want to make is that there are a lot of people that would like to, but they felt that the benefits did not outweigh the...
Senator Monterey Sanderson, I think you're hitting on one of the cogent points, and there's two or three, and I think we all kind of addressed them. One is there's no incentive pay-wise to go up if, in fact, you become a salaried employee, but you really don't have any supervisory responsibility. You're doing the same job as somebody else that's in another car patrolling the same area, but they're calling you a supervisor and they're calling you a sergeant. That's one. I think that's a disincentive for some of the best and the brightest that I talked about promoting up. The other issue is the issue that was talked about as far as the exposure or liability that you would have if you're involved in a critical incident. If you're in the bargaining unit, in many cases you have a legal defense fund that will come to your aid, attorneys that come. If you're out of the bargaining unit, you don't have that access in many cases. So there's a variety of issues, but you have hit on one of the cogent issues that keeps people from moving up the ladder, and I think it's unfortunate because you should have a natural progression of the best and the brightest all the way through to the top. And I think you have right now kind of a roadblock, artificial roadblock being put by the definition we have now.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Madam Chair,
yes.
Senator Anderson, can I just add to that too, particularly from an experience standpoint on that? The other thing is we're talking about these lead workers, those frontline supervisor positions. So the fact of the matter is that really... because of the things that we've articulated, what in essence happens is because these people are prohibited from being in bargaining units, a lot of them never even, you know, get a trial run, if you will, at being a frontline supervisor because they're already out of the bargaining unit. And so I would argue and contend that from a policy standpoint, to allow people to maintain their bargaining unit status but also experience these frontline supervisor positions, you will not only have a better pool of candidates, but you will also find the people that at some point in time will say, hey, you know what, I've enjoyed this and now I need to move up through the ranks to these positions that clearly shouldn't be in the bargaining unit, which we've articulated, and I think you've heard, you know, assistant chief, police chief, those that are truly upper management level positions. And so I think that's something that you need to consider as you deliberate this bill.
Just one follow-up on that. I was a frontline nurse for a long time, and then I became a supervisor and lost any ability to have overtime. And believe me, I put a lot more hours as a supervisor. So that's why I think that there probably could be a fiscal on some of the jurisdictions because of the decrease in overtime. I mean, you're having people working now not being paid for their overtime.
Madam Chair, Senator Mona Sanderson, if I may be so forward and so blunt, that kind of, to me, smacks a little bit of abusing your personnel.
Mm-hmm.
You're working them overtime, not paying them in commensurate for those duties or responsibilities. You're not giving them additional authority. And if that costs them a little more money, then that's kind of a situation that they've created in their own jurisdictions.
Thank you,
Madam Chair. Yes, Senator George.
I kind of want to follow up. Bob, you made an interesting argument there, and I'm trying to get at this, is that somehow we're not getting qualified by people up into the management because of this issue of time and a half. And I guess what I'm trying to get at is overtime or these other protections. It seems like to me those are local decisions, meaning if a local police department feels like they're not getting people who are wanting to, we're not getting high enough quality people to apply for those, they could change their pay status for the supervisor employees to draw those people in there. You see what I'm saying? There's other benefits with being a supervisor that may make you want to work on a salary or whatever else. And I guess it seems like to me that this is, we're really preempting the locals here, that if there's people who make the decision, hey, I don't want to move into a supervisor position because I like the benefits I get right now, and they don't see that incentive being good enough, that then it's the local jurisdiction's job to figure out whether or not they're getting the appropriate candidates applying for those jobs. And so you kind of bring up an interesting argument that's really a bargaining issue, not a state policy issue.
Chair Rosenbaum, Senator George, I would just caution you, let's not get focused so much on the pay issue. I think you heard from my colleague in law enforcement here, there's other protections and provisions that you're afforded when you actually, and as a worker, and particularly in these times, there is a little bit of comfort in knowing that you have a bargaining agreement that addresses layoffs, which addresses health insurance, addresses a whole cadre of issues. And my point that I'm suggesting to you and what you're hearing from people that are in public safety is that under the current supervisory statutes, you're fining people that are making decisions not to move up in the ranks. And so with that, I think there are concerns, and I think you need to look no further than when you apply for whether it's a fire chief or police chief, there's many jurisdictions that are having to go out more than once to find people to find these positions. I saw that when I was on the board. I see that now throughout Oregon, and I would like to believe that while not all of that is because of Senate Bill 750, I think there is an element of that concern that has affected us here as a policy decision here in the state of Oregon.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay, thank you for your testimony. Okay, next panel, Sheriff Rob Gordon, Ralph Wyatt, and Bill Van Vector. Whoever wants to go first, go ahead.
I'll just kick off. Good afternoon, Chair Rosenbaum, Senators, and thank you for taking the time to hear us. My name is Rob Gordon. I'm the elected sheriff of Washington County. I represent the Oregon State Sheriff's Association and myself in this matter, and I'm opposed to this bill. I've been in law enforcement now for over 30 years in Oregon, or I'm on my 30th year, and I started as a line jail deputy. I was a union rep, and some of the things that you've heard today, I at one time agreed with. I don't today. The sheriff's office in Washington County is a big office, 530 people. I have about 60 supervisors that would be impacted by this legislation. They are currently our first level of management, and they are most definitely a layer of management. They exercise accountability in our office. They determine who gets paid overtime and when. They are the first line on initiating discipline when it's appropriate. And they're just solid men and women that do an excellent job. Every promotion I've ever made in Washington County, every one, has been an internal promotion. And these are wonderful candidates. They're standing in line for the job. I turn people down. I turn good people down for sergeants and lieutenants and so on. The economic argument to me is the most important one, and it's one we have to pay attention to today, mainly because of the recession we're in. In Washington County, we're in pretty good fiscal shape compared to almost every other government, local government in the state. But we'll be very, very, very lucky to avoid layoffs this year. And we can't afford any increase in costs, none. This one, I did a totally unscientific poll this week, and I mailed you a letter, I hope you got it, but I asked each of our supervisors, these are the sergeants that we're talking about today, in your work week, on discretionary overtime, the amount, the slips that the deputy has some choice in, whether they're working an hour or 2 hours, whether staying today to write a report or doing it tomorrow, those kind of things. I asked each of them to estimate how much influence they had, and we multiplied that out by the number of folks we had. And on our patrol division, if every hour of that was held accountable and that changed by union membership, we'd be talking about $250,000, a little over that, every year. In our jail division, $208,000 every year. $90,000 in our detective division. Now, I don't think every dollar of that would be lost or saved by this bill. I don't. But I do think it would change. I think the very basic reason that folks join an association, especially a public association, is economic advantage. And to me, that's the biggest accountability piece that this thing will influence. I know these men, these sergeants that represent Beaverton, they're good men. They're honorable guys. And I don't think their integrity would ever be in question. But I've talked to Beaverton command staff who says they can't get the sergeants to control overtime like we can. So I'm asking you today to really take a second, third, and fourth look at this. It really will impact us. It'll change our culture dramatically. When I said that I've promoted these people internally, the few failures that I've had in the sergeant ranks on probation were people that knock on my door and say, "Sheriff, this is a management job, and I know it's a management job, and I just don't enjoy the work." It's not that they can't do it. It's that they want to go back to the line work. Our sergeants become our lieutenants. Every one of our lieutenants was an internal candidate. Our lieutenants become our commanders. Every one an internal candidate. My chief deputy and my undersheriff are internal candidates. And they're very, very good because we mentored them at every step. And every one of those folks, I would guarantee if they were to sit in front of you, they would say that they see themselves in a management role. It's an important role. And it's got to have a very firm line. I agree with that. It's got to have a very firm line, a dividing line. And I'd ask you to protect that line, vote no on this.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Bill Van Vactor, and I'm appearing today on behalf of the Association of Oregon Counties. By way of very little background, I served as Lane County Council for about 15 years and then was its administrator for another 15 years. So I have over 30 years of experience in working with the Oregon's Public Employee Collective Bargaining Act. I am now in private practice in the city of Springfield. In discussions with AOC staff, I have become quite concerned about House Bill 2633 and the insertion of the word independent into the definition of supervisor. AOC has asked me to take a look at that and kind of analyze how would the Employment Relations Board and how would a court likely interpret the word independent. And as I said in my written testimony to you, there's a case called Portland General Electric versus Bureau of Labor and Industries that's cited in my material that indicates that the first rule of statutory construction is that words of common usage typically should be given their plain, natural, and ordinary meaning. I then looked at my Webster's New World Dictionary. I should call it an Old World Dictionary because it's the same one I had at the University of Oregon many years ago, and it's copyright 1960, but it defines independent as free from the influence, control, or determination of another or others. And I am very concerned, and unfortunately that word could go way up the level of command to where it would be the department head or it would be the elected sheriff, and that would greatly expand the definition of a supervisor. In addition, I'm very concerned that with that broad definition of supervisor, then in the collective bargaining unit, it will create a real conflict of interest for those employees that are expected to assign responsibility, make discipline decisions, and so forth. To whom do they owe loyalty? To their other colleagues in the unit, or do they owe it to the elected official that they may be working for? I think that would cause internal stress and be very difficult, and it would just be, I think, much better to avoid that potential conflict by not changing the definition today. I also want to respond to a couple of points that have been made. I concur with Senator George that I think where independent is inserted in the definition of supervisor, it will apply to all employees in Oregon that are subject to the Public Employee Collective Bargaining Act. That the definition is very broad, as is stated. If you look later on, the discussion with regard to public safety lower in the bill has that language notwithstanding. So I think it clearly differentiates and is much more narrow. Also, I want to comment on the concept that there is a vote to determine whether or not these future employees may be in a unit clarification proceeding would then go in the union. I don't have the ORS in front of me, so I just want to testify from my memory and recollection because I can't be absolutely sure without pointing to in Chapter 243. But my recollection of unit clarification proceedings is they can be brought either by the employer or the employee at certain points in the collective bargaining process, depending on where you are in cycle. And I'm not aware of any process. Usually the Employment Relations Board uses one of its hearings officers, and there's a hearing, and the evaluation is made upon the statutory criteria and the facts, the testimony of the witnesses. I'm not aware of a vote in that process at the end of it. So I wish I could be more definitive, but I'm kind of just responding to the testimony. With that, I'll conclude my remarks.
Thank you.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name's Ralph Wyatt. I'm the Linn County Administrative Officer and have been doing that for a little over 17 years. I'm also the guy that negotiates with the four unions that the county has. I really want to talk about the daily functioning of an organization. And Linn County has about, right now, we'll have less soon, about 660 full-time employees. We have over 1,000 names in our payroll system. The way the system works for us is the elected officials of the county sign what's called a personal action form that literally makes whatever the personnel decision, hiring, firing, discipline, whatever, they sign that and then it's official. If they decide it doesn't happen, then it's not official and you don't hire the person, you don't fire the person, you don't do whatever. So we have 10 elected officials that I think meet the legal definition of a supervisor according to this bill. Over 350 of those employees work for the Board of Commissioners. So that means that essentially you've got the three commissioners sitting as a board making a decision affecting as supervisors for 350 employees. You have the sheriff who also has the authority to sign that PAF, again, with 196 employees making that decision, according to the way the bill's scripted. heard earlier from the panel prior that that was not the intent, which gives me a little bit of relief if the language has changed. But basically, you look at span of control in organizations, you look at evaluations, you look at who handles grievances, you look at all of those things that organizations do on a daily basis, and you look at the way the law is currently proposed, and you get nervous about how that organization and the culture of that organization is going to operate day in and day out. And that would be the major concern. We try to resolve issues at the lowest level, and the way this is written right now, it goes the opposite direction. You immediately elevate issues, and not all issues are easily resolved, but the people that get to deal with that issue day in and day out, if they can communicate with each other and work it out, that's the best place to do it. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions for this panel? Okay, thank you very much. And we're going to alternate, so we're going back to proponents, and I will call Arthur Morton, Patrick Hess, and Jeff Lady. And whoever would like to go first, just go ahead.
I'm chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Patrick Hess. I'm a veteran law enforcement officer of over 30 years. Currently, I'm a police officer with the city of Hillsborough. I'm also president of the Hillsborough Police Officers Association, the HPOA. And our organization, our association, represents about 125 men and women of the Hillsborough Police Department. We are also a member of the Oregon Council of Police Associations. I have kind of the unique experience in my career to not only go up the chain of command from police officer to lieutenant, but also come all the way back down and still be alive, for lack of a better term. So I can speak of many of these issues from experience. And being promoted to sergeant with the city of Hillsborough many years ago, frankly, wasn't much of a change in my job. I responded to the same calls as my officers did. I filled out the same reports. I stopped cars. I made field contacts. But the only difference was I filled out a couple of shift rosters, assigned districts, and a couple of administrative things. Going outside of those parameters wasn't necessarily in our best interest as supervisors at that time. Even on major incidents or major crime scenes that happened on my watch, I made sure the crime scene was buttoned up until officer of higher rank came and turned it over to them, and I went back to the day-to-day operations. We were involved in some management meetings, but very short management meetings, because we were never involved in policy discussions, and we were never involved in, or rarely involved in policy discussions, never involved in personnel discussions and management meetings. So that even left us further out of the discipline loop. We were not allowed to discipline. Even if we were going to offer letter of counseling or reprimand, it had to be approved by a lieutenant or above, and many times was issued by a lieutenant or above. And even now, as the representative of the HPOA, very, very few of my disciplinary actions or matter of policy discussions are with sergeants. They're always with the lieutenant or a commander or with the deputy chief or our labor liaison. Rarely, rarely with the sergeant. In fact, recently there was an issue where one of my officers, an officer of my HPOA, was alleged to have disobeyed an order from a sergeant. A letter of reprimand was issued by a lieutenant, not by that sergeant that was even at the scene. And even the letters of reprimand and counseling are boilerplate language that if a sergeant does issue them, in rare occasion, it's just boilerplate language that states the facts of the case and that it's a written counseling or memorandum. I'm skipping through many things because they've been mentioned by some of my colleagues here. But I think one of the biggest thing that comes to light here is representation. And I bring forth an incident that happened this summer. I happened to be on vacation visiting my mom in Montana. About 3:20 in the morning, my phone rang, and it was an officer who was on duty. And the officer told me, he said, "Pat, we've got an incident, an officer-involved shooting. That's all I know right now. I got to go." I immediately got on the phone with my labor representation. I called two of my fellow e-board members, and within 20 minutes, my labor attorney and one of my association representatives was on scene, ready to support and to defend the officer and represent him in legal issues. Once there, however, we quickly learned that it wasn't an HPOA member, it wasn't an officer that was involved, but it was a sergeant. The sergeant, not in the bargaining unit, but responded to the same call, with the same responsibilities at the scene, looking for the bad guy, but it was a sergeant who ended up using deadly physical force against the perpetrator. So within 20 minutes, we had my people there. Within about an hour, we cleared everything up with the HPOA member that was involved, that was there, and they went home. The unfortunate sergeant, with no backup for him, with no representation, sat at the police station with no moral support and no legal representation for several hours. There's still nothing in place that would fix that, and that was in late July of last year. We like to believe that our sergeants are supervisors. It's not the case. They operate under a strict set of guidelines by management, and also they have to follow the collective bargaining agreement of the officers in their charge and the employees in their charge. They don't get representation in civil or criminal matters. And that's just not fair. It's not right. If they're out there doing basically the same job with a few other assignments, basically administrative, then I believe they should be able to have representation and should be their choice to be able to do it. It was brought up a couple times about current represented members who don't promote, and that's a fact in my organization. I know many detectives and officers who would make outstanding supervisors, but aren't willing to leave that protective blanket, and they saw firsthand this summer what happens should that occur. I'm sure, and you're going to hear a different opinion. You already have from the sheriff. In fact, I believe my deputy chief will be testifying. I absolutely respect their opinion and wanting them to respect protect their rights. But it's not about them. It's about the sergeants and the first-line supervisors who are out doing the same job as police officers, and it should be about them. And I would like them, and like you, to afford them the choice of being able to organize. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
My name is Art Morton. I'm a sergeant with the Tigard Police Department. I've been a sergeant there for approximately 19 years. Let me back up. I've been a sergeant for approximately 10 years. I've been with them for about 19 years. One of the things I need to bring to your attention is I'm here representing my own issues and not that of the city's. I was advised before I came down here and testified I should seek the permission from our city manager as well as that of the chief of police. Although I didn't have the time to do that, and therefore I need to separate my personal issues and views from that of the city's. One of the things that I want to bring up to you folks is that I'm not going to be as eloquently spoken as Pat Campbell or as these gentlemen sitting up here or Robert Davis that have already spoken before you. Although I do share many of their viewpoints and I do agree with what they have said, and I know that Senator George has brought up some concerns with regards to quality control and about disciplinary issues. And I know that Madam Chair has brought up concerns with overtime and some financial impacts that may or may not be seen by different jurisdictions within the state. One of the things I do want to relay is that in my time as a sergeant, my viewpoints have changed, my concerns have changed. And the concerns I had when I was an officer and a represented member aren't the same concerns that I have now as a supervisor. In that 10 years, approximate 10 years of being a sergeant, I've never hired anybody. I don't have the authority to hire anybody. I've never fired anybody. I've never transferred anybody.
have never disciplined anybody with financial impacts or sanctions. Quality control is a significant issue in any organization, especially one as important as law enforcement when you're dealing with people's civil rights and liberties. And as a frontline supervisor, if we see something going astray, it's our responsibility to intervene and stop what we see that's inappropriate, to collect that information, to document it, and to send it onward up through the supervisory ranks. Ultimately, it ends up on the chief of the, or the desk of the chief's office. They make the decision of what's going to happen, whether there's going to be implications with discipline or even discharge. Those aren't bestowed upon me. I'm a fact gatherer. Do I look into complaints internally, whether they're generated from our own office or whether they're generated from an external source? I do. And what's always explained to me is I am a fact finder and only a fact finder. I do not make disciplinary decisions. I can't transfer anybody. Never have, never will be given that authority. With regards to overtime issues, supervisors within Tigard Police Department, sergeants are compensated with overtime. With regards to an issue that Rob Gordon brought up, the sheriff, talking about overtime controls and constraints, we have a policy in place for that. And it's relatively simple. If we have someone that has been arrested and taken into custody, the officer that has effected that arrest or an investigator, detective that has made that custody, they will finish those reports prior to going home. Therefore, overtime is incurred as a result of that. If there's shift shortages and we need to basically bring in staff to staff the streets and field the calls, there's a procedure in place for that. Do I have the right to just arbitrarily dispense overtime? I don't. So one of the things that I do have a concern is that supervisors, sergeants, have a voice, and as it is now, we don't. In my career, as a sergeant, I have found myself in the position of having to hire legal representation on two separate occasions. That was not afforded to me, and that was borne at my own expense. I think this is an important bill, and I hope that you see the same importance that I do. Thank you.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Leedy. I am the president of the Oregon State Police Officers Association. I'm also a senior trooper with the Oregon State Police, where I've been employed for just over 22 and a half years. As I was listening to some of the testimony earlier, some of it went through trying to establish a difference between first-line supervisors and line troops. And in my notebook here, I was going through some old notes from our budget hearings, and I came across this handout that the captain of our police or Fish and Wildlife Division handed to the committee, and it says the daily encounters of a Fish and Wildlife trooper. And what it was just examples of what a trooper, you know, encounters on a day-to-day basis, at least in the Fish and Wildlife Division. And there are 13 examples here of what these troopers encounter and do. Of the 13 examples, five were done by either a sergeant or they were involved in the investigation. And we have, I'm guessing, somewhere around 10 to 14 troopers for every sergeant. For every sergeant. So in order for a sergeant to be involved in five of 13 incidences, you know they're out there doing the same things we are. Further, and I want to make sure I didn't misunderstand Senator George when he said that if there's an overtime or a representation issue regarding sergeants or benefits, that should be a bargaining issue. And maybe I misunderstood you, but if that's a bargaining issue, they can't bargain. Not in our department. They have no bargaining power. And in many cases, I'm just going point by point here. In many cases, the department, they don't promote the best candidates. They promote the best candidates that will apply. One of the last disciplines I was involved with as the president of the association, my predecessor conducted that as a sergeant. I thought he was fair. I thought he was thorough. And I don't think the fact that he was the former president of the Oregon State Police Officers Association had any bearing on it at all. In closing, I'll just say we've heard people talk about a fiscal impact. I talked to a sergeant who's retired now, who was a sergeant when they were in our association and then were later removed. And I asked him what the difference was. Was there a big difference from when you were a sergeant in our association and when you weren't? And he told me, basically it came down to this: how much they needed me when they didn't have to pay me, and how little they did, or how little they needed me when they did. Thank you. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions? Okay. Just very briefly, because we do have several.
What I was trying to get at is every time you have hire a manager, you have a contract, you have an employment contract. My office manager, for instance, when she came to work for us last year, negotiated that someday she has to pick up her children from daycare, or drops her kids off from daycare. So she negotiated three extra hours a week that she'd have flex time, and we negotiated that in her employment contract. So if you hire somebody into a management position, what I'm trying to say is those things should be an employment contract between the individual and the employer, not necessarily between a collective bargaining group and employer. That's what I was trying to say.
Madam Chair, Senator George, I understand that then. But as an example, in 1995, I applied for a patrol sergeant's position in the Salem Patrol Office. At the time, the sergeants were represented. During that time, they passed Senate Bill 750 and they removed them. I removed my name from that list. A few years later, I was asked apply for a patrol sergeant's position in Tooele, and when that sergeant voluntarily demoted back into our bargaining unit. And I says, well, what are you willing to pay? Are you willing to start me out at top step, because I was topped out as a senior trooper? Do I need to take a pay cut to take this? Well, I'm sorry, we can't bargain that. So that was it. I mean, there's no bargaining there. So.
Okay, thank you all for your testimony. We're going to try to get through everybody on this list, which means people need to summarize their testimony. So next I'll call Chris Skinner, Larry Harvey, and Cindy Robert. And after that, please be ready to come up, Alex Kyler, Ann Hannes, and Jim Austin. Okay, please sit down and just go ahead.
Well, good afternoon. My name is Chris Skinner. For the record, Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for giving me the opportunity to come down and express maybe a little bit of a different perspective from a management point of view about a culture and an organization that has made it work with respect to the existing legislation, and hope that you will oppose the current 2633 House bill. As I said, I'm with Hillsborough Police Department. I'm the Deputy Chief of Police there. We have approximately 169 employees there, 125 sworn officers, and 20 sergeants that are currently outside of the bargaining unit. And I would submit to you that it's kind of about culture. What we've heard today is an awful lot of instances amongst different organizations that it isn't working for their first-line supervisors with respect to fair pay, wages, and benefits. And I would submit also that is an organizational issue as opposed to a systematic flaw with the way the legislation currently reads. We have the ability for unit clarification. Hillsborough has been through a unit clarification and has successfully defended that. But if we are talking about a state agency that I believe unfairly has compressed the wages of their sergeants and top step senior troopers, then I would submit that we fix the wage and compensation package instead of changing legislation to allow for them to collectively bargain overtime expenses as a way to maintain those particular gaps. We have created a culture in Hillsborough with our city management that has maintained not only good wage gaps, but also that sergeants can attain overtime and be afforded certain protections under city policy, and we think that that's very, very important. The language of independent concerns me just a little bit. As a deputy chief, it could be argued that I don't have the independent authority to impose economic discipline or sanctions, that I must get the final approval from either my chief or city manager. And so it concerns me a little bit about the language of this particular bill and how broad it could be interpreted across all of the supervisory ranks. And I would suggest that we need to take a close look at that. And lastly, I would just ask, there's a question that I have that I would hope that you would consider is that under Oregon administrative rules, there is a question about whether a unit clarification becomes is imposed and we are found to have first line supervisors not be deemed supervisory, if they would actually be able to vote about whether they want to become a part of the existing collective bargaining unit. I've heard both sides of this today in testimony. I think it's an important piece of information for our first line supervisors to hear, that whether or not if the existing association asks for unit clarification and they're successful in that, some would say that they immediately come into that collective bargaining unit. Others would suggest that they have to vote. My understanding is that the only vote that they would take is if they wanted to be a separate bargaining unit outside of the existing bargaining unit within the organization. I think that's an important piece that we need to consider as we look at this legislation and look about what we do for the best for our first-line supervisor. So, in closing, to keep it brief, I'd thank you for an opportunity to come and talk with you. I feel like we've got a great culture at Hillsborough. I think you may hear from a couple of our sergeants. I'm excited that they're here to talk to you as well, albeit they may be in support of this bill, but I am very proud of them and what they do. And, again, thank you for your time.
Thank you. Okay. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Robert, and I'm proud to represent the city of Medford. In Medford, actually, our deputies do have economic control over those below them. And I understand that for every city it's different. The structures are different. We're probably a smaller structure. But they do have economic discipline abilities. But what they don't have is independent discipline abilities. And actually, every employee in the union within our city does not have independent authority, and I would argue that independent authority happens nowhere in our city government. We are based on a culture of collaboration, conversation, and consensus, and I would say even my mayor cannot fire anyone without conversations with others. There's no independent authority. Some of the, and I'll be very brief, some of the arguments you've heard talk a little bit about how people can't find chiefs or different ranking of officers. We haven't had this problem in Medford, and I do feel like we're a little bit different. We're great at what we do, but I will tell you that I do believe it's a local government union bargaining and recruiting tool, and if used successfully, like in Medford, there's no problem getting great public safety officers.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, my name is Larry Harvey. I'm here today on behalf of the City of Beaverton. And I wanted to share with you, first of all, I think distributed to the committee and available for anyone else that wants to take a look at it, is a letter specifically from Mayor Doyle that he wrote to one of your colleagues, Senator Haas, because Senator Haas's district covers the vast majority of the City of Beaverton, although there are some other parts of it that are in other jurisdictions. I want to be very clear as to why the mayor has expressed some very strong concerns about this. It has nothing to do with the performance or the integrity or the absolute tremendous value that both the sergeants in the room and the rest of the force bring to the value and the livability of that community. It has nothing to do with that. He has tremendous confidence in all of the sergeants on the force. As a matter of fact, the police department has a new chief that they went through quite an exercise in recruiting and identifying the best qualified chief, and Chief Spaulding is
very new on the job, been only there about 120 days, but has expressed concern not because he's concerned that someone will misappropriate or misinterpret their role of authority, but specifically there are concerns, again, about the language. Beaverton is different from most other cities in the state of Oregon. In fact, the mayor is the city manager, if you will. So as the city manager, he doesn't even get to vote with the city council unless there's a tie, which generally can't happen unless someone's not at the city council meeting. But he is responsible for budgeting, for finance decisions, and would, in the chief's absence, have absolute authority to make a decision regarding economic discipline. That generally would be made by Chief Spaulding. However, that doesn't mean that other officers, and I'm not talking about patrolmen or sergeants, I'm talking about specifically situations where lieutenants or captains don't have that authority. They are not independent. They report to the chief. So the bottom line here in the city of Beaverton situation, which raises concern about this type of legislation, is that just looking at those, not sergeants, we assume that sergeants are or will become members of the collective bargaining unit, so this has nothing to do with collective bargaining rights. It has to do with effective services provided to the citizens of Beaverton. The figure for fiscal impact potentially on the city of Beaverton, and I can't speak to Gresham or Hillsborough or anyone else, but I can tell you that we figured that out just based upon the lieutenants and captains, because independence would mean that, in fact, they are not, so therefore would not be considered supervisors anymore by definition in this bill, and the fiscal impact in 1 year would be $714,000. By the time we potentially have an opportunity to come back and tweak this bill, if it's passed the way it is now, that would be a $1.4 million impact on the city. That could have untold devastating effects. Now, does this mean that this is not an important issue, particularly to the state patrol officers? No, that's not what the mayor had to say. The mayor had to say that he's charged with the responsibility of providing important services to citizens and that this would be extremely detrimental to the city budget. We've already budgeted for overtime for the officers who deserve that overtime. That's not, again, brought up in the issue. So I want to be clear that the mayor is not concerned about collective bargaining. He's not concerned about who's doing their job. He's concerned about how does he get to do his job if, in fact, this legislation is signed into law. So that's the bottom line for the citizens and the mayor of Beaverton. And again, if you have any questions about that, I too would be happy to answer them.
Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. The next panel, please come forward. Alex, Kyler, Ann Hannes, Jim Austin, and then we have two more people. We'll try to get through them, too, and that's Brenda Wilson and Colin Nealand.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name's Ann Hannes. You have my testimony before you, so I won't go through that. Just in summary, AOC is opposed to this bill because we are concerned about the narrowing of the definition of the supervisor. We want to have effective operations for counties. We do believe that people out there have honor and integrity in their jobs, and that's something that we feel very strongly about. But this bill is really about how do we maintain effective operations, keep our costs in line given the tough economic times, and have the flexibility. And I think the testimony you heard from Bill Van Vactor, Sheriff Gordon, Ralph Wyatt, and others underscores that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, I'm Alex Kyler. I'm Lane County's Intergovernmental Relations Manager. I've submitted for the record some testimony, and we had hoped to have Commissioner Bill Dwyer up. He was up earlier in the day and sends his regards, but he couldn't stick around. But we did prepare a letter, and the impact, we focused on the aspect of the bill that speaks to that independent authority language, and again came up with a very significant fiscal analysis, as well as some concerns about what that would do to the organization beyond in terms of just a scope of control. So what you would have is a very large fiscal impact, minimum being $2.2 million to cover all those employees who would now not earn in the same manner that they do right now, and leaving just 22 employees who would actually have the ability to manage those employees in terms of discipline. So pretty significant change for the organization if that word independent remains in the bill. We didn't prepare any testimony really on that latter part of the section that speaks to the public safety officers, but I would submit that our sergeants do earn comp time right now as part of their bargaining agreements, and I think it speaks to what Senator George was referencing earlier, which is that the organization has its own unique approach to this with its own collective bargaining agreements, and we'd like to continue along that same line.
Okay, thank you.
For the record, Jim Austin, Clackamas County Community and Legislative Affairs Department. I'll follow up. Clackamas County, our sheriffs, just for the record, our sheriffs are represented in collective bargaining. Our sheriffs are overtime eligible. Right now, our in terms of economic discipline, that's something that the sheriff, that the sergeants or the lieutenants and the captains currently do not have. But I'm primarily here to talk about that independent language portion that's in there. There's been a lot of people who, or some folks who have come in opposition to the bill talking about the cost of this. And I, too, have some costs that I'll, some numbers that I'll share with you. But let me talk a little bit about the methodology of what I did. I had our HR department run a list of, give me a list of all the people who are currently in the county who are non-rep. And then I said, you know, and then I pulled out from that anybody who was an elected official, anybody who was a department director, so our clerks, I took out our county administrator, so basically anybody who had independent, total independent authority, and that's primarily only the county administrator and department heads. What I got is a list of about 255 people who are currently non-rep employees, who do not have independent authority, who would presumably be included in a bargaining unit. And I ran the cost for if they were to work 1 hour a week. A lot of supervisors do work overtime, and that is uncompensated at an overtime rate. If all of those folks did 1 hour a week throughout the year for all the pay periods, it would be $7.3 million a year, and that's at 1 hour, and that's straight time. Presumably, if they were in a bargaining unit, they would get time and a half for that. So 7.3 is pretty substantial. Also, a lot of our bargaining units in Clackamas County are on a 37.5-hour work week. So alternatively, you could be looking at a significant loss in capacity if those people were to go back to, you know, I mean, you'd be looking at two and a half hours times 256 times 52 weeks a year. That's a lot of lost capacity. That's all I have to say. Just wanted to add on. We're very concerned about this. Again, we don't have a lot of people in our organizational structure of about 2,200 people who have that absolute independent authority to hire or fire folks. It would be about 25, 27 people in the whole county.
Okay. Thank you very much. And apparently there were two other people who we missed, and that, in addition to the people I mentioned, Bruce Kelly and Dave White, and then I'm not sure what the last name is, but so be ready to come forward, Jim. And the last person I had called was Colin. I assume that you're Brenda and Colin Nealon?
Yes.
Okay. So go ahead, and then we'll take that last panel.
Thank you, Chair. For the record, Brenda Wilson, I'm the Intergovernmental Relations Manager for the City of Eugene, and we are here to testify in opposition to this bill. These types of bills are very difficult for the City of Eugene, these bills that pit, so to speak, management against labor, especially where the bills concern our public safety personnel. We are in opposition to this bill for three reasons, basically. We believe that House Bill 2633 will create difficulties in the day-to-day operations of our staff. We believe that the financial impact is something that the City of Eugene can't absorb right now, and we believe that this has far, apparently, unintended consequences for supervisors across our organization. First, the difficulties of the day-to-day operations. In no way is the City of Eugene implying that that our, especially our public safety officers, both police and fire, lack integrity. We're talking about day-to-day operations where labor and management often don't agree on administrative issues, and that can make it difficult to carry out those day-to-day operations that supervisors have to in order to keep our organization going. As far as the financial impact for the city of Eugene, we looked at this on a very small scale just to give you an idea, because we're not exactly sure what the implications are for supervisors that don't have independent authority. But for us, we believe that this bill would impact everyone in our public safety arena, outside of the police chief, the captains, the fire chief, and the division manager. So we have 33 police officers that this would impact at an annual fiscal impact of $140,000 a year, and approximately 8 fire personnel at $70,000 a year. The city of Eugene is currently facing a $12 million budget deficit for fiscal year 2010, which means that every dollar counts. And I know you've heard a lot about what people should be getting paid, and that overtime, not being paid overtime, is taking advantage of these employees. And we're not here to argue about whether or not those policy decisions need to be made, or whether or not that needs to be changed. The fact of the matter is, this is how the city of Eugene operates, and we do pay our management service that do work overtime. We provide them with additional paid vacation. It's not 100%, but some of these employees receive 75% paid vacation for the amount of overtime that they work. But that's different than paying them overtime, because for the city of Eugene, the city assumes the 6% PERS member contribution that goes into their individual account program at PERS, and the city of Eugene has an 11.37 employer rate that we have to pay. So when we're paying someone overtime, we have to pay an additional 6% plus an additional 11.37% into the PERS system that is not being paid in addition when we give somebody paid vacation, because that's not an additional amount, and we haven't budgeted for that. And the third point is the apparently unintended consequence of supervisory people that do not have independent authority. The city of Eugene has approximately 1,500 employees, and depending on how broad the term independent is defined, we could be talking about a large number of people, and I think that our fiscal impact or financial impact to the city of Eugene would be close to what you've already heard. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions and cut this short. Thank you.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Colin Nealand. I'm the budget manager for the Oregon State Police. And to be clear, I'm here today to be, I'm neutral. The agency is neutral on this bill. We're simply here to provide some background information for the fiscal impact that was prepared for the legislature for this, especially in light of the current economic times, and to answer any questions that you might have. When you look at the fiscal impact that the state police provided to the legislature earlier in this session, we worked very closely in preparing the fiscal impact with the Human Resources Services Division of the Department of Administrative Services. And we did that because of all of the testimony you've heard today. There are a lot of questions regarding this bill on who would or would not be qualified as supervisory and who would or would not be potentially eligible for overtime. In my conversations with the folks over at Human Resources Services Division, they looked at our agency and they made the determination that our sergeants and our lieutenants would be deemed to be overtime eligible under House Bill 2633. The state police has 95 sergeants and 41 lieutenants that then would become overtime eligible under this bill. And the fiscal impact to the agency, assuming what we would consider a fairly conservative estimate of 22 hours of overtime per month, in the first, what we're looking at an implementation halfway through this next biennium. So halfway through this next biennium, the fiscal impact would be $3 million. And when the impact fully takes effect in the 11-13 biennium, the fiscal impact to the agency would be over $6 million. And what we would also ask, we understand this is a committee that looks at a lot of policies and makes those kind of decisions. What we would ask is if the committee can make a subsequent referral to Ways and Means for House Bill 2633 so that this bill, which has a large fiscal impact upon our budget, could be looked at in the broader context of the overall budget for the Oregon State Police, especially in the light of the current economic times. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have at this time.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you both for your testimony. And our final panel, please come forward. Bruce Kelly, Dave White, and Mark.
Madam Chairperson, if we could have separation between the two groups, it was supposed to be me and Sergeant.
Oh, all right, sure. Yeah.
From July.
And whoever wants to go first, go ahead.
Madam Chairwoman and Council, for the record, my name's Dave White. I'm a police officer in the city of Hillsboro. I'm also a sergeant. I'm here on my own time, as is Sergeant Kelly. I've been a sergeant since 2002. It's been difficult to sit in here, honestly, on both sides. I hear some things from the pro side that is very frustrating as a sergeant, and then I hear things on the con side that is very frustrating as a sergeant. One of the things that is difficult for me is we work in kind of an environment where sparks fly. We go to the same calls as the people who are wearing the vests. We're wearing vests, we're putting them on, strapping on guns, and we're going to those calls. And we go to those calls consistently with the officers. When we arrive at those calls, we have to make decisions as to how that call is handled, direct people where to go to make sure the job gets done. That's a frontline supervisor, and that's what I feel I am, as a frontline supervisor. I am not afforded the same representation that the people I supervise have when I'm doing a very similar job. If I'm involved in an officer-involved shooting, and we had one approximately a year ago with a sergeant, when that sergeant was involved in that shooting, initially he had no representation, no legal representation, no attorney. He was a suspect in an attempted murder or an assault one. That is the reality of what happens when the hammer drops. And he got back to the station, and his initial representation was going to be a city attorney. And I think we can all recognize the inherent danger in that for both the city and the individual. And the city recognized it. And to the credit of our department at the Hillsboro Police Department, the chief went ahead and authorized the city to get that sergeant a criminal defense attorney and work through those problems with the criminal defense attorney. Now, although I know now that I have that same protection, if my administration changes, if my city administration changes, that's gone for me. We had an agreement with the old city manager that the compression would not take effect, a contract without a contract. Compression's taking effect. We have a new city manager. I would like the opportunity, personally, to have one set of rules that I get to live by. I would like the opportunity to pay for my own attorney if I am involved in an officer-involved shooting, or if I am involved in a civil issue, paying for it with a group of other people in an association. I am not a proponent of going into the same associations as that currently exists. I would like to have our own as sergeants. I see a difference between, Madam Chair, Senator George, not to answer your question, I don't think there is absolutely no integrity issue with doing investigations, sergeants investigating officers if they're in the same association. But I think that it's a lot easier to do that job when it is delineated, when it is different. And that's all I have.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chairperson and Board, my name is Sergeant Kelly. I'm a police officer with the City of Hillsboro. I have the distinction of being that sergeant that keeps getting referred to. Firsthand knowledge on the city did a great thing for me in that situation, but there was like 45 minutes of what's this going to bring on me personally. So just because of expediency and all, just maybe if you could put a face to a situation.
Okay. Thank you both for
Thank
coming
you.
Forward. And last but not least.
Madam Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee. My name is Mark Mackler.
and I am an attorney. I represent about 125 different public safety organizations in Oregon and Washington. I represent the Hillsborough Police Officers Association, the Beaverton Police Association, Washington County Peace Officers Association, the Tigard Police Association. What did I miss? I have Clackamas County units. I deal with Sheriff Gordon. I deal with Deputy Chief Skinner. My law firm represents groups in Linn County, in Lane County, in Eugene, in Newburgh, in Gresham. And so I am intimately familiar with public safety and this issue that we are talking about, and this House bill, which I did testify on the House bill side as well. I want to clarify, hopefully for you, just a couple of points with regard to the unit clarification process that have come up. There have been some questions about how does that work. First off, there has to be a choice by the people like sergeants who would not be represented. The Hillsborough sergeants, the Tigard sergeants who have testified before you, would have to make a decision as a group whether or not they even want to be represented for purposes of collective bargaining. That's the process to begin the process. Then a petition would be filed with the ERB, which allows the employer and the designated collective bargaining group. It could be a sergeant's bargaining unit, or it could be the Hillsborough Police Officers Association wanting to have them join the sergeants, have them join the Hillsborough Police, would have an opportunity to go through a process of litigation to even determine whether or not that's the appropriate collective bargaining group. Assuming that that becomes the appropriate collective bargaining process, those sergeants then get to vote whether they join, not the entire bargaining unit, those people who are specifically at issue. So I can clarify that. That is the administrative process. That is the Employment Relations Board process. It still is subject to checks and balances. I want to clarify something else that I've heard. There's been a lot of discussion about fiscal impact, which is interesting to me. The statute change that is being proposed has to do with the word independent. It has nothing to do with the ability to pay. It has nothing to do with interest arbitration for public safety employees in the state and changing the statutory definitions that are already in place under 243-650. If Lane County, Eugene, Tigard, Hillsborough, Portland, Gresham, Newburgh, whomever it is, can't afford to pay, they have ultimately the ability to take that position if they are bargaining with a group. But the only way to do that is to bargain, to provide an opportunity for that group that may want to be represented and that may want to have those choices about their health insurance, about their wages, and about overtime, to actually bargain with their employer. It requires the ability to have a choice. That doesn't exist, and that's what this bill is about. And I can stop there because we're short of time, and I appreciate it. I will answer any questions if you have them.
Okay. I think we are, in fact, out of time. So,
can I just ask
yes,
one question? Not
ahead.
For you, though, but in the bill, on the last page, on line 14, they added nurse holding a similar position. And is that charge nurses in hospitals? Is it who are you referring to there?
Madam Chair, Ramona Sanderson, that is a grammatical rephrasing of the existing statute. It doesn't change the status of how nurses are handled at all. But in drafting the bill and changing the next sentence, the drafter chose to rephrase that existing statute.
So just a clarification. Okay, thank you very much. And committee members, thanks for hanging in here. We will close the public hearing on House Bill 2633, and we are adjourned.